Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State, but please call me Mike. Today I'll be talking with Philip Cunliffe about his book, Lenin Lives, Reimagining the Russian Revolution, 1917-2017, out with Zero Books in 2017. Dr. Philip Cunliffe is a senior lecturer in international conflict at the University of Kent's School of Politics and International Relations. His research interests include peacekeeping, humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, self-determination, sovereignty, critical theory, and IR theory. He is the author of Legions of Peace, UN Peacekeepers from the Global South, out in 2013, Cosmopolitan Dystopia, International Intervention and the Failure of the West, out in 2020, and also out in 2020, The New 20 Years Crisis, A Critique of International Relations, 1999-2019. He has also published several anthologies. If his voice sounds familiar, you may recognize it from Afe Bunga Bunga, which bills itself as the Global Politics Podcast at the end of the end of history, a tagline that I'm very, very jealous of. I love that, at the end of the end of history. Philip Cunliffe, welcome to New Books in History.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. So before we get into Lenin Lives, which I think will be a really fun discussion for listeners of New Books in History, because this is a different type of historical thinking and historical writing. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. You have a doctorate in war studies. What led you to this career, and what led you to the topics that you study?
Yeah, so it's formally in war studies, though really the thesis itself was in international relations, and it was on developing countries' role in peacekeeping, or how developing countries in the post-Cold War era ended up sending such large global deployments of military force around the world under the umbrella of peacekeeping. And it was a topic that fascinated me because it was so counterintuitive, that you had frequently poor and weak states rather than wealthy and powerful ones being so heavily deployed in war zones around the world. And so I studied for it at the Department of War Studies at King's College London.
Could I ask what your case studies were in that? So, I assume Cambodia.
No, so there were no case studies. So it was based on, it was more an institutional analysis of the United Nations itself, rather than the either the countries where the peacekeepers were deployed, or the countries that deployed the peacekeepers. There were one or two mini case studies, but really it was an institutional analysis of the internal functioning of the UN itself and how that refracted the various kind of political processes at work. But it was in the War Studies Department at King's College London, which includes everyone from international relations theorists to naval historians to strategic theorists. So because I was there, it was a PhD in War Studies, though technically it's an international relations thesis. What drew me to the career, I suppose, and to academia was that I still think it's true, that academia is still one of the few places left where it's possible to pursue political interests intellectually. So an interest in politics and history in an intellectual and hopefully rigorous and scientific way. And that's very difficult to do in any other kind of job.
Yeah. And I think in both, you're calling from the, we're talking to you and you're in the United Kingdom and I'm here in California, and neither nation state is providing great examples of politicians with strong intellectual interests.
No, that's definitely true.
So, and also I want to quickly talk about your podcast Afe Bunga Bunga, which I'm a big fan of and strongly recommend to listeners. Can you, before we get into the book, can you give us a little pitch for the podcast? What do you guys talk about? Who's involved, and what's the mission of Global Politics Podcasting at the end of history? And I'm so happy every time I hear that that tagline, because I can't stand Francis Fukuyama.
So it's so as you say, it's a podcast. I co-host it with my two collaborators, George Hoare, who's based here in the UK, and Alex Oakley, who's based in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And I suppose our aim was to provide a perspective on global politics, as we term it, at the end of history, which is to say that we try to examine it in the aftermath of this, of the 30 years since the end of the Cold War that were generally seen as kind of ideologically centrist and ruled by a liberal technocratic consensus, which Francis Fukuyama famously, notoriously described as the end of history. And it seemed to us that period kind of fell away, or began to fell away at least, you know, roughly around the time of the great financial crash, and then that the political backwash of the financial crash was felt maybe 10 years later, and especially, I suppose, with the and most significantly with the election of Donald Trump in 2016 and with the Brexit vote in Britain to secede from the European Union. And I suppose because that post-ideological era seemed to be crumbling away, we styled the podcast as being at the end of history. But it actually originated just from kind of the informal chats that we had in, you know, social messaging services on social media and what have you. And we thought that it might be useful to kind of structure it and to see if people were interested in listening to the kinds of ideas we were batting back and forth. And thus far, fortunately and happily, they seem to be so.
Yeah, well, I've been listening.
I'm delighted to hear it.
And it came recommended to me from a friend who's actually not an academic. He's got a real job, and said, "Here's the smartest podcast you need to listen to right now." I said, "Okay, all right."
Oh, wow.
So, in the introduction to Lenin Lives, you quip that when your students asked you what kind of a Marxist you are, you once replied, "Gonzo." And I chuckled that, not only because I'm a Hunter S. Thompson fan, but because I've gotten that question from my students, and I always respond with vulgar. I'm a vulgar Marxist. So what's behind that answer? And if it was a sincere answer, a sincere term, what do you mean by gonzo Marxism?
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose I meant it at least half sincerely. And to be fair, I mean, I'm pretty vulgar myself. I think it was the British author James Hartfield who was the first to use it. And when I say it, or when I used it with my students, it was partly as a prop, as a way to kind of gently swipe away questions about the arcania of various kind of Marxist political sects and affiliations, whose history, I mean, as I'm sure you know, and as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is kind of so intractable and repellent often. And I think also with respect to my teaching is also mostly irrelevant. So, you know, to that extent, it was half serious, but I did mean it more seriously, I think, with respect to the argument of Lenin Lives, in as much as I tried to weave into the narrative of Lenin Lives, into the book, I tried to weave in elements of social critique and self-satire into the argument, which is what Hunter S. Thompson meant by gonzo when he coined the term. So to that extent, I think it is, you know, I also wanted it to be a kind of an accurate depiction of the kind of thing that I try to do in the narrative of the book, which is at odds with, much other kind of Marxist accounts of politics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I understand the term, and this isn't exactly what Hunter S. Thompson was talking about when he coined the term gonzo journalism, but when I apply it, it's good, solid work that's bending rules, and often bending rules in a fun way, but for productive purposes. And I think that that's you know, Lenin Lives is, you know, is counterfactual history, maybe gonzo history in that regard. It's bending some rules that my profession abides by.
I think that's for
all the right reasons, right?
It's a great line from Thompson, and I definitely subscribe to it.
Yeah, yeah. So in Lenin Lives, you stress that Marx and Engels self-identified as scientific socialists. So what would this term entail, and what are the implications for, shall we say, applied Marxism? Why is it important to remind us of that now?
Yeah, so it means to have a theoretical account of the conditions for the emergence of socialism from capitalism, which also incorporates an account of the social and political agency by which that transformation takes place. And this was lacking in the utopian socialists whom Marx and Engels criticized. Following Hunter S. Thompson, in as much as Gonzo is based on incorporating the participation of the protagonist into the narrative, then I guess you could also say that Marx and Engels were the first Gonzo socialists, in as much as they differentiated themselves from their predecessors by identifying the possibility of socialism with the political agency of the industrial proletariat, and also that they attached themselves so firmly and decisively to the working class's political struggles of the 19th century. So I suppose in as much as it was important to stress that, it was important to talk about political agency, because that was so central to... Yeah.
Yeah. So that just put a little spark in my mind. So is the famous thesis on Feuerbach about the purposes, you know, what is it not to previous philosophers have studied the world, the purpose is to change the world. Is that Gonzo socialism?
Yes, it is, in short, I think.
So Gonzo philosophy.
Yeah, Gonzo philosophy and Gonzo socialism, in as much as the protagonist, the agent, is at the core of it, and that transforming the context involves transforming the agent themselves, because the making, I suppose, in the Marxist schema, in as much as the working class becomes the ruling class in that process, the working class itself is transformed. So yeah, I think I would stretch the argument to say that they were the first Gonzo socialists.
Yeah. So Lenin Lives is not a, you know, scare quotes, normal history or academic history. It's a counterfactual history. And it reimagines a better 20th century. It's premised upon the idea that Lenin's health held up just a little bit longer, a little bit better. And his health held up partially due to a successful revolutionary wave that swept Europe after 1917, as opposed to the failed revolutionary wave that eventually led to Stalinism in the Soviet Union and liberal compromises with fascism in the West. So why write a counterfactual history? And let's pretend I'm a boring, stodgy historian, and sell me on counterfactual history. What's the value here? Sell the genre to me.
Yeah. So counterfactual history, as the name suggests, it's history against the facts, against what actually happened. And as you've suggested, the genre is generally frowned upon both in history and in social science. And I think in some respects, at least for good reasons, because it's difficult enough to establish, what really happened in any particular case. So why make things more difficult for ourselves by asking how things might have happened differently? And the fact that this kind of genre tends to rest so heavily on contingency in the historical process also means that it's often been seen as a prop for conservative historiography by stressing randomness and contingency in the historical process rather than the grand patterns of deep historical development. The latter obviously being more associated with Marxism, although, in fact, it was pioneered in the stadial theories of historical progress that were devised by the leading thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, including, of course, Adam Smith himself. And I suppose as a popular genre, counterfactual history is most associated with those kinds of weird, creepy, forlorn, and these kind of wistful accounts of what if the rebel slave states had succeeded in breaking away from the Union during the U.S. Civil War, or if the Nazis had won because Hitler invaded the USSR a few weeks earlier, or whatever. So, I mean, there is a kind of... there are understandable reasons, I suppose, to be skeptical of counterfactual history.
It is sort of the domain of right-wingers. And yeah. I just finished that 6-part documentary on QAnon and the message boards. And it's sort of the Denzians of the 8chan world. Seems like this would be the audience for a lot of these like right-wing counterfactual histories. What if the Confederate States had won? What if Hitler had, got this gun at a certain point?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to, partly part of the inspiration for writing the book was to break the stranglehold of conservative historians, but also that creepy kind of popular version of the genre. Because it seemed to me at the same time that serious attempt to grapple with revolutionary history is itself inherently counterfactual. And reading through the Bolsheviks' own accounts of the debates they had and the political calculations they were making about whether or not to try to overthrow the provisional government towards the end of 1917, their own calculations were based on thinking through possible scenarios, which they, fully accepted might develop one way or the other. So it seems to me that there, it is legitimate and consistent. It is not inconsistent with a kind of history that is able to account for deep processes and grand patterns, but at the same time can also incorporate the idea that there are specific points at history where historical agency matters a great deal, and that there are kind of branching points which send historical development down particular trajectories one way or the other.
Yeah, I think your point about doing history of revolutions is really essential for understanding the value of this counterfactual experiment, because this book, more than traditional sort of political histories or biographies of the Bolsheviks, gave me more of an understanding of how they were thinking and what they're looking at, a range of possibilities and going through a range, shall we say, in today's parlance, gaming out various possibilities. And I was, at one point in my life, I was a Soviet history major, promptly flunked out of Russian. So I had to retreat to French history and Southeast Asian studies. And then found out how difficult Vietnamese was compared to Russian. But anyway, I digress. In reading sort of those classics, I got a narrative of the decisions that were being made, but not necessarily the way that historical actors were thinking through possibilities.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because, like I say, I think it is, like I say, not only legitimate but in fact necessary in order to understand at least the Russian Revolution, if not indeed other revolutions. And to that extent, I think so. Yeah, I certainly want to make the case for this kind of counterfactual history as something which can be done, which can be incorporated into broader accounts of history without damaging the integrity of our understanding of the historical process.
Yeah, and calling attention to certain without being so the great man in history kind of approach, but calling attention to certain turning points, the importance of contingency. If this had not happened, then what could have been the possibilities? Again, gaming this out, and I mean this in an extremely complimentary way, but this book reminded me of some of the better examples of science fiction. And using that genre as a way to not to go into the past, but to go into the future and play out different scenarios. My graduate students told me to start watching The Expanse, which I started a few weeks ago, which I think is a pretty darn thoughtful, well-informed sci-fi show. And evidently For IR theory folks, there's a lot to wrestle with there. And so having, you know, prepping for this conversation, having just read your book and then doing this deep dive into binge watching the Expanse during COVID times, I got it. The light sort of went on. And I think that these non-traditional kinds of historical explorations writing, I think really would be of value for academic historians to engage in. But so I already alluded to it, but what is your premise here for Lenin Lives? When does what shapes your historical timeline in this counterfactual history?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I mean, it's based on what is, I mean, some of it is based on very uncontroversial and very conventional accounts of the Russian Revolution, in as much that it is, you know, commonly understood and accepted that when Lenin arrives from exile in the midst of the First World War, when he arrives from exile from Switzerland back into Russia, famously turns up at the Finland station after the Tsar has been overthrown, that Lenin is the only one who wishes to overthrow the provisional government and to, as the slogan had it, put all power in the hands of the Soviets. And it was this, the political vision that he articulated in the April theses that indicate the importance of the individual in a particular kind of historical juncture, Lenin's own kind of political vision and agency, and the fact that he kind of assiduously work to persuade the rest of his the rest of the Bolshevik party to side with him, because in that particular point most of them were still favored extending their support to the provisional government. So it grows out of, like I say, a kind of uncontroversial account of the facts of the Russian Revolution, and then kind of branches out to draw out a narrative out of what would have happened if the Russian Revolution had succeeded in spreading westward, which was indeed what the Bolsheviks hoped for, intended, but also they incorporated that assumption into their calculations about when to seize power, because it was based on disruption that was happening with the war effort in Europe, with mutinies and strikes breaking out in different places. So as you mentioned,
and it is also central to Lenin's thinking when he's negotiating the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, right? I mean, they famously say that, you know, the lines on the map don't matter now because the world's going to be engulfed in the flame of revolutions in a few years.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you alluded to, the premise kind of going on from there, the premise of the book is that Lenin lives a little longer, helping to smooth the international spread of the October Revolution to Western Europe. But the major conceit of the book, I suppose, is precisely that the westward spread of the revolution makes, paradoxically, makes Lenin himself a far less important figure from the viewpoint of this alternative historical timeline. And like I say, I mean, this was the premise of the Bolshevik strategy in overthrowing the provisional government in Russia, that it would help to detonate revolutions further afield. So the Bolsheviks' wager was indeed that they would themselves quickly become far less important once the revolution had spread to the wealthier, industrialized great powers of Western Europe and eventually to the US itself, all countries which had large, powerful, and well-organized labor movements. And so the book recounts that counterfactual history, that history against the facts, interwoven with or shot through with strands from actual history, hopefully allowing the reader to compare kind of what could have happened and what did happen in parallel.
Yeah, I think it's really important because so in many conventional historical accounts of this time period, so much of the significance and the potential power of initially the mutinies, then the strikes, and other forms of social and political agitation from Paris to Seattle, Washington, especially as we get towards 1919, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a moment like 1968 or like 1848 or what have you, where there could have been this much larger revolutionary process, and especially as you play out in the book, as they're feeding off each other, there's a snowball impact, or whatever the metaphor. I'm from Honolulu, Hawaii, so the snowball thing's really dramatic to me. But evidently, a snowball rolls downhill and gets more snow. So I've read, that they would feed on each other and not only give sort of moral support, but create more political space for left wing possibilities and. This like sort of deeper international revolutionary resonance, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So that there would be a mutually self-reinforcing effect, which was what revolutionaries of the time expected, what the leading labor organizers of the day expected, what the political and indeed, I mean, what the counter-revolutionary statesmen, also expected and dreaded and feared. So this idea of this cumulative wave of self-reinforcing strikes, mutinies, national uprisings from Ireland across Central and Eastern Europe through to revolutionary overthrow of the governments of the day, all of this factored into the way in which people understood the stakes of what was going on in that period.
Yeah. And as you play this out, as you look over the course of the next century, what would the impact of this be? Is that this starts off the 20th century with this incredible moment of international solidarity, to the point where international isn't really even a thing because the nation state disappears, right?
More or less. So I work on the premise that of kind of. On the premise that if you'd had the success of socialist revolution in the early 1920s and through the mid-20s to the end of the 20s, that you'd have had a vastly different world. And so the basis of the counterfactual narrative is kind of subtracting some of the counter-revolutionary blocks of the era. So if fascism is a response to the failure of revolution, and if Stalinism is a response to the failure of revolution, then logic suggests that if the revolution had succeeded, then Stalinism and fascism, you can kind of remove them from the historical narrative, from the historical process. And that already seems to me to be a much better world. If the socialist revolution had spread to Western Europe and was able to build on the civic and democratic achievements of the organized labor movements of the day, then presumably you could have had the expansion of democracy and the expansion of civic freedoms and equality on a much larger scale, much earlier in the 20th century than we actually saw, because obviously the struggle for kind of civil rights, for all sorts of equality, of the extension of suffrage to women, all of those processes, the disestablishment of national churches, all of these things took far longer to play out over the course of the 19th century, sorry, of the 20th century. So basically this rapid accumulation of progress. So the beginning of the 20th century without war, without fascism and without Stalinism and all of their kind of associated horrors would lead, it seems to me, it's logical to say that it would lead to a much more improved 20th century much earlier on, so that we get better international cooperation, we don't get the trade wars of the 1930s, there's no Second World War, there's none of the kind of violence and bloodshed and upheaval that's associated with it, so you have a much more solid cumulative record of growth, as well as political, civic progress. And all of these things would also be self-reinforcing and would lead to further and more rapid improvements in scientific advances, in the dissemination of scientific advances, in public education, in the emancipation of women, in the dissolution of the empires in Europe. All of these things seem to me, it would be safe to say that they would have happened quickly and more smoothly had the revolution not been blocked and impeded and retarded by the actual course of events in the 20th century.
Right. And one of the questions that I was drawing up for you was, and I think you've answered this, who's more important in this narrative, Lenin or Luxembourg? And I think you answer Luxembourg, that the German revolutions, in many ways, this imagined success of the German Revolution, shall we say, would be much more important than the success of the Russian Revolution. So that would mean a, as you say, a more European revolution, which would mean a more German revolution and thus a more German Marxism. So what do you want to convey by highlighting that, a more German Marxism and a more German revolution?
Yeah, so as you say, I mean, the failure of the German revolution is, in the book, I suggest it's more decisive in the history of the 20th century than the Russian Revolution. And it's not a single event, I suppose, but it stretches from the overthrow of the Kaiser and the brewing civil war in Germany in 1918 through the turbulence of the early 1920s, throughout which the German workers remained highly organized and militant and of a revolutionary temper. So implicitly, it does mean that the German workers' leader, Rosa Luxemburg, is more important to the narrative. But I don't focus too much on the kind of the crunchy detail of those years, and that's a deliberate choice because it, I want to stress that it was a, that all these processes are themselves cumulative. So it was a series of cumulative defeats rather than any single episode. And so to focus on any single kind of precise moment, I think, would be to undercut the argument of the book, not least the fact that eventually these kind of series of cumulative defeats are themselves transmutated into supposed gains and victories. So, you know, improvements to the living standards of the working class in Germany resulting from the Social Democrats' early welfare state is kind of sold as a victory, rather than seeing it as a response to the defeat of the German Revolution. And of course, the idea of socialism in one country, the philosophy of Stalinist Russia, is also seen as a victory, as a gain, rather than as a defeat of the earlier vision of revolution. So to say that it would have been a more, that a Western European revolution would have been a more German Marxism is to underscore the fact that, you know, the way in which we think about Marxism, as, you know, kind of soldiers in fur hats and jackboots trooping around in Red Square, that itself is, it's an artifact of the history of the 20th century. It's a contingent outcome of the revolutionary turmoil of the post-war era. And had the revolution spread westwards, the memory and the retrospective understanding of Marxism would be very different.
Yeah, that makes me think of a point I once heard Tariq Ali make in an interview that during the course of the Civil War, so much of the St. Petersburg working class died, and that so many peasants who had not developed the same level of workers' consciousness were brought into the Red Army and then became really the backbone of this new revolution. And they hadn't gone through the same historical, again, transformation of consciousness. That's an important point that's often sort of lost in the narrative. Like there's this internal demographic shift within the Bolshevik movement as it becomes the Soviet movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And the history of the Russian Civil War and all of the wars that kind of occurred on its on the fringes of the old Tsarist Empire in Finland, in Central Asia, in the Caucasus, all of that story is, is still not really appreciated in Western historiography. So, I mean, yeah. We have a much better, you know, there's much more kind of, I think, popular consciousness, say, of the importance of the Eastern Front in the Second World War, but still very little real kind of popular appreciation of what happens in the Russian Civil War and just how important it is historically in terms of its precise kind of results, as you suggest.
Yeah, I mean, I loved some of the asides that you went into in regards to the white forces in the Russian Civil War. You know, just bringing up some of the really vile actors in that made up, you know, these various factions within the white forces. And you mentioned the Baron von Ungern, the Buddhist warlord, who promised an anti-Semitic genocide under the banner of the swastika. And this is years before Hitler's on anyone's radar screen. And I think you refer to him as a Buddhist version of ISIS out in Mongolia. I mean, there's so many just sort of bizarre aspects of white terror and the white anti-communist forces in the Russian Civil War, but also this is something that I've worked on in Southeast Asian history and Indonesian history. I mean, there's this resonance of this, you know, really kind of nutso nature of some of these anti-communist movements over the course of the next century. Why did you want to bring that in? And was this sort of like some of the traditional parts of the history that are silenced in most narratives?
Partly, but I think it was also very much to stress the point that, to underscore the point that you just made, that the kind of the murderous iteration of exterminatory anti-communism that recurs throughout the 20th century, it begins really in the Russian Civil War itself. But then, as you say, kind of plays out, I mean, with you got the White Terror in Hungary following the suppression of the Hungarian Soviet Republic, the fascists and Nazis of the interwar period, as well as the Spanish Civil War and the Second World War, and then right through to the kind of the Cold War era death squad regimes of Indonesia, Latin America in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I suppose, and as well, I think, you know, it should also be remembered that in as much as Stalin killed off most of the old Bolshevik party in his purges across the 1930s, I think he too was part of that wave of anti-Marxist mass murder that unfolded across the 20th century. And given, I suppose, how much violence was unleashed, the intensity and the ferocity of that kind of counter-revolutionary violence is testimony, I think, in some sense, to just how high people's aspirations had been raised through socialism, through various forms of anti-imperial struggle, through communism, and that it required that inordinate amount of violence and bloodshed and terror in order to crush those aspirations. So that was part of the reason of stressing the white terror of the Russian Civil War, but also because in the counterfactual narrative that I develop, obviously it's with the defeat of the Baron von Ungarn, it would be in that kind of alternative timeline, it's the last time that the swastika would be raised as the banner of a racial exterminatory war of such terrifying kind of irrationality and cruelty and violence. And unfortunately, that isn't the world that we live in. The world that we do live in, the factual historical world, is the world in which the swastika would be raised again in a very similar kind of campaign to the one that the Baron von Ungarn waged in Central Asia during the Russian Civil War.
Right. This reminded me of a recent book by Filipino sociologist Walden Bello. Counter-revolution, the global rise of the far right. I'm going to talk to him in a few weeks. And I think that, you know, historians have been really good at writing histories of global communism, international communism, what have you, and have been much weaker at looking at international anti-communism and sort of the international white forces. And I got to talk to Vincent Bevins, wrote the Jakarta Method a couple months ago on the podcast. And I think he has done such a great job as a journalist connecting the dots between far right anti-communist violence in Southeast Asia and Latin America.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, reading that section of Lenin Lives, took me back, you know, further back from the Cold War into the origin of the revolutionary moment with the Civil War, and that those forces are there. I got to ask you about your discussion of Churchill in there, which was especially with what's been going on with various sort of popular debates about history in the UK and so forth. But you seem to have a good time taking the old guy down a few pegs. Tell us about Churchill in your alternate historical timeline.
Yeah, I have to say, probably the author's relish came across perhaps in those sections. It's part. So I talk about Churchill, what Churchill's career would have looked like in this alternative timeline, what his life would have looked like, and I dwell on it partly because Churchill himself was a counterfactual historian. So he wrote one especially creepy narrative, in which a victory of the Confederate States in the U.S. Civil War leads to this kind of prolonged Anglo-Saxon global hegemony, in which the Confederate States are one of the three pillars of this weird racial utopia, the British Empire being another one of the pillars. But So, I mean, partly, you know, it's, I think it was kind of dealing with other kind of counterfactual stories that I dwelt on Churchill, but also it was a deliberate narrative device, which I tried to tell the counterfactual story through the lives of famous personalities as a way of bringing alive the argument. And in so doing, I also wanted to show that historic change is expressed more through people's lives rather than by a history of great men. And thus, in my counterfactual narrative, Churchill's life is obviously, on the one hand, it's dramatically altered by the achievement of a socialist revolution in Britain, which leads him to kind of, in my narrative, flee and attempt to establish a monarchist government in exile abroad. But in the other ways that his life would have been in many ways similar as well to the one that he actually lived in the actual historical world, which is to say he was prone to depression. He was frequently a politically isolated figure who was seen as a crank for quite a bit of the interwar period. He was a mediocre painter. And so all of these kind of individual quirks, I think they also would have expressed themselves in the changed historic circumstances, which I recount in the book. And so I suppose it's a device through which I try to convey some of the underlying purpose of counterfactual history itself. And to try and show how, you know, you can alter some dramatic circumstances in thinking through, kind of imaginatively thinking through an alternative historic timeline. And there will still be things that will still look familiar.
Yeah. And it's all the more delicious when you note that he wrote a counterfactual history.
Yeah.
That has this white supremacist fantasy. So, okay, yeah. let's do this to you.
Exactly. Yes.
On the other end of the political spectrum of sort of political personalities, in your reading of the political trajectory of the global South in this alternate narrative, you present a history with no Ho Chi Minh, no Che Guevara, no Ben Bella. Walk us through that as it involves rethinking nationalism and the nation state and decolonization.
Yeah. So in the book, I mean, I suggest that the global South, or the way at least in which we conceive of it at the end of the 20th century, at the start, or I suppose at this in the first quarter of the 21st century, itself is an artifact.
Oh, you can say it. It's the end of the end of history.
The end of the end of history. Fine, thank you. I'm glad I needed your permission.
Just so long as you don't have to send him royalties every time you say
No, luckily not. Okay. No. But yeah, so the global South at the end of history, I suppose the implication of the argument and the one that I try to put across in the book is that the global South itself is an artifact, I think, I argue, of the isolation and containment of the Russian Revolution, which means that revolutionary upheaval remains trapped in the periphery and effectively becomes a constant reiteration of the Russian experience of socialism in one country. Arab socialism falls apart into the socialism of individual nation states in the Arab world, African socialism the same, Chinese socialism again, socialism in one country. And all of this is all socialism that's predicated on the Stalinist model of industrial catch-up and geopolitical rivalry with the West, rather than the classical Marxist ideal of socialism based on boosting up from liberal democracy. So had revolution successfully spread westward from Russia after 1917, the conceit of Lenin Lives, the conceit of the book, then I reckon that the old European colonial empires could have been upgraded into larger socialist commonwealths and federations that would have been transcontinental, not unlike the way in which the old Tsarist empire was upgraded into a Soviet federation by the Bolsheviks. Thus, the failure of the revolution, it seems to me, is vital to help us understand how the nation state became the dominant political unit of the 20th century, making people like Ho, like Ben Bella, like Guevara, romantic national heroes for an era of national liberation. Because, I mean, had the revolution in the metropolitan country succeeded, I argue we never would have had the need for national liberation struggles in the global South. Because as the empires were overthrown at home, they would need to have been overthrown abroad. And thus the lives of Guevara, Ho, and Ben Bella would have looked very different in the alternative timeline that I plot in the book.
Yeah, in Vietnamese history, where I do much of my work, there's this, you know, this decades-long debate of, was Ho Chi Minh really a communist or really a nationalist? And
yeah, you know,
it's in some ways it's just a dumb question.
Yeah,
it's both. But in this book, he would be nationalist, or maybe wouldn't. Would not be nationalist. Would be a communist, and wouldn't need to go down that path. Due to this international collaboration. As someone who, again, who works on imperialism, works on Cold War in the region, I found that to be such a fun thought experiment.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, it cut against my initial starting point as well. So, because so much of my work, as we started chatting at the beginning, I mean, so much of my work has been based on thinking about the way in which imperialism has been recreated in different forms at the end of the 20th century, not least in forms of liberal internationalism, you know, seen in the United Nations and so on. So, you know, my sympathies have always been with trying to understand the politics of the global South and struggling against circumstances that are so kind of imposed from outside and from abroad. But as following the logic of the argument and following the logic of this thought experiment, as you say, to try and plot this alternative timeline, it took me in a very different direction from where I initially started. And so the idea of thinking of a world without the need for revolution in the Third World, because revolution had happened in the West, it was kind of very, like you say, it was very unexpected for me too. So,
yeah. So, you've touched on some of these issues earlier, but what would be the socialist, the implications of a socialist victory for science, for healthcare, for the environment? I mean, you mentioned previously there'd be this structures for more international cooperation and also not the avoiding wasting the resources on things like Second World War, Cold War military spending, and so forth. So, game that out for us. What do you see happening in this alternate 20th century?
Yeah. So, on the assumption that so much of the story of science and progress throughout the whole of the 20th century is bound up with geopolitical rivalry, and so much technological and scientific development is retarded by nationalism, by fascism, by mass murder, by camps, death camps and exile, and all of the kind of terrible depredations. If that is removed, then you have much greater scientific improvement. You have many scientists, many important cultural public figures and so on living longer, and also able to advance the pace of technology and science further without the need for kind of state secrets, without the need for it being constrained to arms buildup and imperial rivalries and what have you. So the assumption is that if you have greater public investment, which isn't caught up with national rivalries and arms races and what have you, that there is the possibility for improved standards of living much earlier, and also the possibility for greater scientific advances, you know, just in a very basic sense of scientific congresses involving people meeting from all, you know, all different countries. And just even the basic mechanics of scientific cooperation were so kind of curbed and restricted by the experience of the interwar period and subsequently by the Cold War. So all of this, I assume, would boost scientific advancement and progress, and the upshot also would be more rapid global economic growth. And thus, I suppose, you know, by following the logic, more rapid global warming, appearing presumably earlier in the last century. But by the same token, if you'd had socialist governments established in the Western world, which is to say in, you know, the wealthy, most technologically advanced core of the international system, it would presumably also be a more technophilic world, and a world which has transcended imperialist and geopolitical rivalries through various forms of international socialist federalism and so on. It would find it easier to address that enhanced climate change in a collective fashion, because you would need far less coordination across independent national capitals and different kind of power centers, and it would be less caught up with geopolitical rivalry. And so therefore, the assumption in the book is that even though you would have You would have global warming emerging as a problem earlier in the previous century. We would also have the resources to tackle it earlier and more effectively, with less of the kind of lag and difficulty and friction and general sluggishness which we're confronting today.
Yeah, I thought the environmental discussion in the book was one of the moments where I really got sold on the counterfactual thought experiment, because it gets so sophisticated the way you take the reader through that. It's like, well, yes, based upon Marxism and the scientific socialism, there would be this dramatic increase in industry, which we now in 2021 know would have these environmental impacts. But then you keep gaming through that and like, well, how would this different political scenario respond to that? And for, I teach a course in 20th century world history. So the rise and fall of Marxism in communist states is obviously an important theme in that. And it's really difficult working with my students to get them to engage in historical empathy, because they know how bad it's going to get, right? They know that something really bad happened in the 30s, and then it continued to be pretty bad. And they've got some images about the Soviet Union in the late 70s and early 80s of, breadlines and whatnot. A lot of it's lax context and everything, but they know the experiment goes wrong. And so it's really difficult for them to get into the optimistic mindset of the revolutionaries. And, especially the folks who you just noted were, wound up in the basement of the Lubyanka prison in the mid-1930s, getting a bullet in the head. That really the core Marxist intellectuals of the party, who had an entirely different approach to problem solving and collaboration and so forth. So again, I found the book just so inspiring, and like it's definitely going to impact how I teach this history in my 20th century world class. So you've been, I could go on forever. I can just keep asking you about these various threads, but with a book like this, there's also the problem that there's spoilers. I don't want to, you're giving an alternate history. So I don't want to take the wind out of your sails. So I just strongly recommend to listeners to dive into Lenin Lives and explore this project. You've been really generous with your time, and I've got two more questions before I let you go. First, can you suggest two books for the listeners?
Yeah, happily. So I guess two books I've been thinking about recently. So one is Michael Lintz, The New Class War, which is a concise, superb short overview of class politics in the Western world in the era of this kind of seemingly intractable clash between liberalism on the one hand and populism on the other. And the other is a book called The Left Case for Brexit by the US political theorist Richard Tuck, which does exactly what it says on the tin. And they're both books which I found very useful for thinking about politics today in Britain and in the US. So I'd strongly recommend them to your listeners if they're interested in those questions.
And then the second title was The Left Case for Brexit?
Yeah, The Left Case for Brexit by Richard Tuck.
Yeah, I recently listened to your podcast on Scotland and Brexit. And I really appreciated the way that one of your guests had admitted her sort of ambivalent thinking about Brexit and the European Union, and her, I think she noted that most of her repulsion to Brexit was on aesthetic grounds, and the racism, but at the same time, boy, was it tough for her to defend the European Union, alternate historical timeline. If there was an European Union that put labor ahead of capital and environmental regulations ahead of economic growth, I would wave that flag. But the way it played out,
No, absolutely. I've always been willing to give. I've been willing to give the European Union the benefit of the doubt in terms of whether they would actually be capable of building something better out of the nation states of Europe. But I think, unfortunately, it's just been proved time and time again that that it's an institution that's congenitally incapable of that. So it can only really kind of degrade and muddle through rather than actually kind of improve or build something better. So for that reason, you know, I think Euroscepticism is warranted. Though, as you say, you know, our guest on that particular episode, Kat, she expressed very well, I think, a lot of the ambivalence and difficulty that many on the left had in Britain, and how torn they were over this question.
Yeah. And then finally, what are you working on now and what can we hope to see from you next?
So the book I'm working on at the moment, or the tentative title for it, is The Mutual Ruin of the Contending Classes. And it's one of the scenarios that Marx and Engels mentioned themselves in the Communist Manifesto of 1848 as one of the possible outcomes of class struggle. And it seems to me it's a scenario that's kind of very, very, hasn't really been explored, but seems to me very important for any kind of political history or social science, which incorporates an account of class conflict and class struggle, that it also think through what that scenario might look like, not least because it was given prominence by the founders of founding fathers of modern communism themselves. So that's the current project, the current book project.
Great. Well, Philip Cunliffe, thank you for chatting with me.
Thanks. It's been great. Thanks for having me on.
So this has been a conversation with Philip Cunliffe of the University of Kent and co-host of the Afe Bunga Bunga podcast about his new book, Lenin Lives, Reimagining the Russian Revolution, 1917-2017, out with Zero Books in 2017. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.